Now I want you to turn back tonight again to the book of Job, and tonight we'll go to chapter 27. Actually, we're going to try and cover about 5 chapters tonight. And I'll explain to you why. If you have been following through in these studies in the book of Job, you know the setup now of the whole book. The background was laid in the first 2 chapters, that controversy that was going on between God and Satan. Job becomes the target. And then, of course, there's that whole series that we've been going through where his 3 friends came along, and each one in turn makes a statement. But bear in mind, it appears that they had made up their mind that Job was a guilty man. He had done something that was extremely wrong, and God was punishing him for that sin. That was their conclusion before ever they started dealing with the case. And then they took turns. Eliphaz goes first in the first cycle, and Job answers him. Then Bildad speaks. Job answers him. Then you have the third man, he speaks, and Job answers him. And then there comes the second cycle, and they go through that again. Then you come to the third cycle, and Job is an answer for every one of them. Eliphaz gives his speech again, his third time. Bildad gives the second one. But then, somehow or another, Job gives his answer in chapter 26. We saw that on Wednesday evening. It would appear that when you come to the end of chapter 26, there's a kind of pause. I suppose that most of them would be looking for this man, Zophar. As much to say, now it's your turn. What have you got to say? And they're waiting, but he's silent. Now, what caused him to go silent is anybody's guess. It may be that he said all he had to say in the twice that he had had the platform in which to speak, and he had run out of anything else to accuse Job of. Or it could be that when he heard the clever answers that Job gave to the other 2 on the 3rd round, he thought to himself, what's the good? I'm not going to speak again. He'll just give me another mouthful, the same as he's given them. And I'm not clever enough to deal with this man. So he goes silent. Now I know that there are some people who believe that he comes in again and speaks here, but that doesn't seem to fit in. From chapter 27 through to the end of chapter 31 is Job that's speaking. He's not answering them now, really, not directly. But now if they've said all they've got to say, then Job says, as it were, now it's time for me. I'll take the platform now, I'll take the floor, and I'll pour out what's in my heart. And again, I want to remind you that in my judgment and the judgment of others, Job was far more intelligent than these other 3 men. And they were not novices at the game. They also were intelligent. There were many principles that they understood. Many things that they could express with intelligent words. But Job was above them. Now here in these chapters, he's going to pour out his heart and state what he's got to state without interruption. In chapter 27, he's going to assert again his integrity. Oh, by the way, if you care to take all those chapters in, I may sum it up now by saying this. We're not going to excuse Job. He's an intelligent man, highly intelligent, able to express himself in language that perhaps is superb. But it would appear that there is a lesson that he has never learned. As I've been rereading these things, he reminds me very much of the man that the Lord spoke about and recorded in Luke chapter 18. That man who went in before God and said, I thank thee, I am not as other men are, etc., 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 etc. I'm not even like this poor publican, so on. He was a man who was presenting himself before God in all his integrity. And you remember there was another man there who said, God be merciful to me, the sinner. Now, in this particular section, Job reminds us of that Pharisee, that proud Pharisee who was presenting himself. Later on, by the time you come to the end of the book, he takes his place like the poor sinner, and he's saying, oh God, be merciful to me, the sinner. But at this particular point, he's presenting himself. Now let us look for a little how he maintains his righteousness, chapter 27. Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, as God liveth, who hath taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who hath vexed my soul, all the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you till I die. I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast, I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. Let mine enemy be as the wicked, and he that riseth up against me as the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he hath gained? When God taketh away his soul, will God hear his cry when trouble cometh upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God? I will teach you by the hand of God that which is with the Almighty will I not conceal. Behold, all ye yourselves have seen it. Why then are ye thus altogether vain? This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors, which they shall receive of the Almighty. If his children be multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Let us pause there. You see, if you were to go back again and try to capture some of the accusations they were laying against Job, some of the principles that these men propounded, Job now is agreeing with them. In plain words, he's saying, now many of the things you've said to me are true. I'm not arguing against the principle of them. But nevertheless, I want to tell you this. I'm not one of the men that you're speaking about. I'm agreeing with you as to what God will do with the wicked. Now you see, if you go back over some of Job's answers, you would think he took up the opposite view from this. You would almost think in some of the answers that he gave previous is this. You would have thought he was trying to maintain that God was blessing the wicked and dealing with the righteous. That's not what he was saying at all. But here, when you come to this part, he's dealing with the thing again, and he's saying, now, I agree with what you men say. But the fact of the matter is, God's judgment doesn't come down immediately. It would appear that God's blessing them, and they may have a lot of material blessings, but sooner or later, judgment will be their portion. But I'm not one of these men. And he's standing here again in his own integrity. He's asserting that he has never done these things. And you know, you must admit with me, he's right. But nevertheless, no matter how much a man may be able to parade himself and to express his own righteousness, that will not give him an acceptance with God. That's why I referred you to the man in the New Testament. Who could point the finger at that man's moral standard? I thank thee, I am not as other men are. Well, you know, you only need to take up your daily paper today and read concerning some of the things that are happening. And I'm almost positive if you don't say it out loud, you're saying it within your heart, well, I'm glad. I'm glad I'm not like that. I'm glad I haven't been dragged into some of these things that people have been dragged into. I'm glad that I know better than that. Well, you see, there are a lot of people today who live what you would call self-righteous lives. They're not Christians. But if you judge them from the outside appearance, you would almost think they were Christians. They live good moral lives. They do everything they think is right. And they give to this charity and they give to that charity. And they wouldn't say a wrong or angry word about or to anyone. And they live good, upright lives. But that doesn't give them an acceptance with God. Because you know the principle of the New Testament is very clear that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And God wants to bring us to that. And when we see ourselves in the light of God's glory, we see ourselves as nobodies at all. But you see, Job here is speaking for himself now. He's still maintaining his integrity. And he said, I will not say anything that's wrong. I'm not telling lies. And I'm not going to do anything that's wrong. But he says, now the wicked is different. Now see what's going to happen to the wicked. And so he goes on about those wicked people. Now having stated all this in chapter 27, where he's setting forth his own integrity and his own self-righteousness and his own goodness, and then he contrasts that with what will happen to the wicked. And even if a wicked man does have a lot of children, he says, why, they're only there for the sword. Sooner or later they're going to be in trouble. Now when he comes into chapter 28, you have a different matter altogether. Here he's dealing with true wisdom. Now, I like chapter 28. There's a lot of truth in it. Let's look at this chapter for a moment or two. True wisdom, which is priceless, you could write over that chapter. Surely, there is a vein for the silver, and a place for gold, where they find it. Iron is taken out of the earth. Oh, by the way, stop there. Did you think that men knew way back in these days how to dig down into the earth and get all those treasures? Or did you think that was only a modern idea? So way back in the book of Job, he knew then that people were digging down into the earth and getting some of the treasures that God had put there at the time of creation. And then he goes on to say, they've taken this out of the earth, and brass is molten out of the stone. He setteth an end to darkness, and searcheth out all perfection, the stones of darkness, and the shadow of death. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant, even the waters forgotten of the fruit. They are dried up, they are gone away from men, as for the earth. Out of it cometh bread, and under it is turned up, as it were, fire. The stones of it are the place of sapphires. They're the dust of gold. There is a path which no fowl knoweth, and which the vulture's eye hath not seen. The lion's whelps have not trodden it, nor the fierce lion passed by it. He putteth forth his hand upon the rock. He overturneth the mountains by the roots. He cutteth out rivers among the rocks. And his eye seeth every precious thing. He bindeth the floods from overflowing. And the thing that is hid bringeth he forth to light. Then you have a hinge here that brings you to another truth. But, where shall wisdom be found? Now that's what he's dealing with in chapter 28. True wisdom. And how priceless it is. Now you think of all the so-called works of men. I'm sure men have been very wise in the way they've learned how to tunnel into the earth. Not only have they brought out those precious stones, they brought out the gold and the silver. He doesn't mention it here, but you and I know at the present time how they've brought out cobalt. You know, cobalt has become a very precious metal. But there's a place away up in Ontario in Canada. I remember being there long time ago. 35 years ago I visited away up there on a visit one time. And there were a man showed us round at cobalt. It takes its name from the metal that's there. That's where the silver mines used to be. And wherever there's silver, there's cobalt. It's just the same as when you get coal, you'll get rocks. But when they went into those mines, the cobalt was thrown away. It was useless. It was the silver they wanted. When suddenly now, they discover that cobalt was a very, very precious metal. And instead of mining for silver now, they're trying to redeem much of the cobalt that they threw away. And a long time ago, over 50 years ago, cobalt bloomed again. It had become almost a ghost city, or a ghost town. They thought they'd rot out all the silver. Folks were leaving it, no work for them. And it bloomed again. And now they started. And they set up a great big place up there experimenting with cobalt to take it out of the rocks, out of the ground. So there's gold, there's silver, there's precious stones. There's all these things they take out of the earth. Man has shown an awful lot of wisdom. Perhaps he's a lot of knowledge. He knows how to get these things. And at times they learn what to do with them. There's great value placed upon them. But the question is that real wisdom? See, Job says there's something else, but, where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof. Here's something that is absolutely priceless. What is it? It is true wisdom. Man has gone for the treasures of the earth. But there is a hidden wisdom, a hidden treasure. Oh, when we come to the New Testament, we've got the answer, haven't we? James says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask for it. Now, I've told you here often before, I don't know where I first learned it, but it stuck to me and I've passed it on. If you want knowledge today, it costs a lot. You don't get knowledge for nothing. It costs some folks a lot of money to spend years in college in order to gain a certain measure of knowledge. We're thankful for the knowledge that some of them have gained. You must thank God for the knowledge of the physicians and the surgeons. A lot of them, we've got to thank them for their knowledge. But that knowledge cost them something. Not only did it cost them a lot of money to pay their fees, it perhaps cost them a lot of anxious hours in their study. It may have cost them years to gain knowledge. But there's a difference between having knowledge and having wisdom. He says, if any man lack wisdom, not the wisdom of men now, not the wisdom that cometh from beneath, but the wisdom that cometh from above, that's true wisdom. The wisdom of God. If any man lack wisdom, let him ask God, and he'll give it liberally. Here this man is dealing with true wisdom. Where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Look further down the chapter. Look at verse 19. The topaz of Ethiopia shall not equal it, neither shall it be valued with pure gold. Whence then cometh wisdom? Where is the place of understanding? Seeing it is hid from the eyes of all living, get close from the fowls of the air, destruction and death, say. We have heard the pain thereof with our ears. God understandeth the way thereof, and he knoweth the place thereof. For he looketh to the ends of the earth, and seeth under the whole heaven, to make the weight for the winds, and he weigheth the waters by measure. When he made a decree for the rain, and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then did he see it and declare it. He prepared it, yea, and searched it out. And unto a man he said, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. The fear of the Lord. There it is. In plain words, Job is maintaining again where he stands. You men have shown an awful lot of understanding of certain principles, perfectly true. But there is a wisdom you don't have. You've never reached this point yet where you've got any fear of God. And this true wisdom takes us right down to that basic principle. And unto man he said, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Now they could say what they like about Job. He knew perfectly well what he had passed through, as you show you in a moment or two. But the fact of the matter is, in all his deplorable state, he says, I'm here. I fear God. And that is true wisdom. Now let us search ourselves. Would we rather have the wisdom that rests with these men who have studied all the sciences and don't know God? Or would we rather have the wisdom that starts with the fear of God? I don't know if I ever told you this before or not, but I remember cutting this out of a magazine, filed it somewhere, I don't know where it is now. That's what happens when you file things away, you lose them later on, don't know where they are. My system must be wrong. But I cut this out. This man, he was a professor, teacher, a lot of letters behind his name, wonderful fellow. All those that sat under his teaching admired him. But when they got talking together about him, they said, isn't that a funny thing? He's all this knowledge. He knows how to do this and how to do that. And he understands this. He can't even drive a car. He's no driver's license. Boy, some of the kids 16 years of age are anxious to get that license, aren't they? Some of them can drive before they're 16, although they shouldn't be. And then they go and get the license at 16. And here's a man who has gone through and he's gained this and he's gained that. All his honors. Imagine, he can't even drive a car. They thought this was awful. But you see, it's possible for a person to have an awful lot of learning, an awful lot of understanding of certain things, and yet to have missed a vital thing in life. No fear of God. And here's a sinful man or woman who's had no education whatsoever. Brought up in the country and they've had to do their chores when they were children. And they've had to work on the farm or on the ground. They've had to work hard all their life. They can hardly read or write. But they know the Lord. And that's a greater knowledge than the professor in the university who's on his road to hell. Where is wisdom found? It starts right there. Wisdom is found. Where is the place of understanding? It starts with the fear of God. And Job takes them right back to that place. But now let us look. Having stated these facts, in chapter 28, and by the way, if you go down through chapter 28, he doesn't seem to be answering any of the arguments that these men brought against him at all. He's away here now on a line that's far above what the arguments have been about. But now you come to these other chapters. In chapter 29, Job looks at his past. In chapter 30, he looks at his present. In chapter 31, he looks to the future. I'll see if we can gather some of the highlights out of these. Chapter 29, the past was characterized by greatness. Now, you and I know what Job was in the past. We learned that in chapter 1. One of the richest men of his area. Man that was looked up to where he lived. Man who had a big family. 7 sons, 3 daughters. He would have his own big house. And all his family married, they had their houses. Look at now, chapter 29. Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me, when his candle shined upon my head, when by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in the days of my youth, when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were about me, when I washed my steps with butter and the rock poured me out rivers of oil, when I went out to the gate through the city, when I prepared my seat in the street, the young men saw me and hid themselves, the aged arose and stood up, the princes refrained talking and laid their hand on their mouth, the nobles held their peace and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth." Let's stop there a moment. It's obvious in the reading of this what he's doing. Here is a man who's reviewing the past. He's thinking of his prosperity, the days that used to be. You know, I remember when I was young, like some of you here tonight, it was always amusing to me to hear some of the older folks speak of, the days that used to be, those grand old days. Those grand old days. I don't know if you've ever listened to them talk about the grand old days or not. Ladies, it was a grand old day when it became washing day, wasn't it? And those tubs and baths had to be brought out with the scrub boards. If you had told them then how it was possible to put your washing into a box and press a button, the next time you went, you took them out, and that was it, they were all washed. They wouldn't have believed you. Oh no, it could never be done like that. The grand old days, wash day was a whole day. The washing's out in the line. And the shower came on and everybody had to rush and help to bring in the washing off the line. 30 minutes later it was dry again and had to be put out again. If it rained all day, well, at night time they were hanging all over the house. These were the grand old days. When you had one fire to heat the whole house, you went to your bedroom at night and took a hot water bottle to try and heat the bed. The grand old days. When they didn't know how they were going to make ends meet. Once a year they got a week of idle time. They called it holidays. Well, you didn't get paid for it at all. Not a bit. I remember when they started paying us for a week's holidays. But you got paid because they kept so much of your wages the whole year before it. And when they kept it off, and that was for your holidays, then you got paid. You'd already earned it. They called it holidays. These were the grand old days. But for Job it was different. He's thinking of the past, and he's thinking of the blessings of God that came upon him, the days of his prosperity. When everything seemed to prosper, his land was prospering, his family were prospering, he was prospering. When he went out to the gate, men looked at him and bowed themselves in honor of him. The neighbors acknowledged him. People listened to him when he spoke. He was a man held in honor. These were the grand old days. He's thinking of that. Prosperity. He was praised. He had honor. But you see, the whole thing is this. Things have changed. He's thinking of the past and wishing perhaps that that had continued. But for some reason or another it had come to an end. He's no longer living in those prosperous days. Things have changed. Go to the following chapter. Chapter 30. See how it starts. But now. But now. Here's another hinge. But now. You see, he's contrasting the past with the present. But now. They that are younger than I have me in derision. It's a novel thing when young folks hold old people in derision. They're passing by now. Those that once bowed to him and said, that Job, he's a wonderful man. Great amount of wisdom. See how he's prospered. Best man in the area. Now they're passing by and they said, hey, look at him. Sitting in the ashes. Huh? He's lost all that he had. They're holding him now in derision. Whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock. He would have disdained to have set these men with his dogs. And now their children are holding him up to derision. But remember this, the deriding Job. There were those that derided the Savior as well. He was held up to derision. Yea, whereto might the strength of their hands profit me? In whom old age was perished. For want and famine they were solitary, fleeing into the wilderness in former time, desolate and waste, who cut up mallows by the bushels, juniper roots for their meat. They were driven forth from among men. They cried after them as after a thief, to dwell in the cliffs of the valleys, in caves of the earth and the rocks, among the bushes they brayed. Under the nettles they were gathered together. They were children of fools, yea, children of base men. They were viler than the earth. And now am I their song. Yea, I am their byword. They abhor me. They flee far from me. Spare not to spit in my face. Because he has loosed my cord and afflicted me. They have also let loose the bridle before me. Stop there. It's obvious in the reading of this how he feels now in the present. He who once sat in the place of authority, as it were, in the gate, the man that they came to for help and instruction, now they're passing by and they're spitting in his face, holding him in derision, making a mockery of him. That's how he felt. He had lost his all, he had lost his family, he had lost his friends. He lost his health. Nobody to stand by him, and he couldn't get contact with God. It's contrasting the present with the past. Now let's hurry. I leave you to read that chapter at home and see how he felt. You come to chapter 31. He's looking to the future. I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? For what portion of God is there from above? What inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is not destruction to the wicked, and a strange punishment to the workers of iniquity? Doth not he see my ways and count all my steps? If I have walked with vanity, or if my foot hath hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. Let's stop there. I'll leave you to read the chapter at home. Here's a man looking now, and he's saying this. He's claiming that he is upright. He said, look, I haven't even let my eyes rest on a strange woman. Carry that over to the New Testament. Remember what the Lord said? Adultery. In dealing with adultery, he said, why, there are some people have already committed it in thought, if not in act, in thought. And it just needs the occasion when they carry it out. Job says, I haven't been like that. God knows my integrity. I haven't even sinned with my eyes. Flames. Uprightness. Go down the chapter, he claims kindness. He claims purity in worship. He hasn't turned to idols. And by the way, you know one of the greatest idols of New Testament times? covetousness. Covetousness, which is idolatry. You'll be getting it in your mail this week. You may have already won $10 million. You may. You may. What a chance. In a million. Only come in week after week from this place, that place, and some of them you've just got to send this, you've just got to send that, and you may. Oh yeah. People are so covetous. The old devil knows it. He knows how to bait the trap. He knows what to put it. Job says, I have not been an idolater. My worship has been pure. I only worship God. You see, he's claiming here where he stands. Purity in worship, purity in friendship. Then he issues this challenge. He challenges man and he challenges God. If anything I've said isn't true, step forward and prove it. If you can prove anything against me, let me know what it is. That's why I started off by saying he takes the place of the Pharisee. I thank thee, I'm not as other men are. I've never done this, I've never done that. I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. But he'll have to wait till God speaks to him and he'll take the place of the poor sinner. He's saying, behold, I am vile. And it's then that he's completely reconciled to God. Now after he concludes with his monologue here, you'll find another young fellow steps forward who appears to have quite a lot of intelligence. And he's going to speak. He'll give his criticism of Job. And he'll give his criticism of the other three. And while he says an awful lot of wonderful things, even he hasn't come to the crux of the matter. None of them know what God's doing. And only when God speaks will Job learn. And his friends will learn the whole truth. Let us bow together in prayer. We'll ask our brother Herbert to close and dismiss us with a word of prayer.